Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Sarah Dykstra. On this edition of the podcast, we'll hear from Sharon Jackson as she talks with State Representative Charlie Brown and what he's doing to end food deserts. You'll also hear from Jill Sheridan as she reports on how having a parent in jail can impact the child's health. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The Food Bank of Northwest Indiana has been leading the region's fight against hunger since 1982 and distributes more than 4 million meals each year to hungry kids, adults, and seniors across Lake and Porter counties. This time of the year, their efforts turn to feeding kids who are out of school but still need their breakfast and lunch meals, and the food bank makes sure they get the food they need. Lakeshore Public Radio, Stephen Lattimore has the story.
According to the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana, for thousands of children and teens across Lake and Porter County, summer break means they lose their breakfast and lunch at school. But thanks to the Food Bank Summer Feeding Program, they'll now get the food they need. Shonda Dixon runs the Summer Feeding Program for the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana.
Well, we're happy. This is our sixth or seventh year doing the program, and basically we're partnering with the East Chicago Park District, providing them with breakfast and lunch. It's a daily delivery of breakfast and lunch meals. Currently we're starting out with 2:30, but we do anticipate that number to rise as the summer increase. And basically we are providing the sites with the food plus supplies free of charge.
This batch of lunch and breakfast meals is going to the Park District in East Chicago.
So it can consist of a cereal bowl, a fruit cup, cereal bars. They receive the milk and juice. And then our hot lunches or cold lunches are prepared through Meals on Wheels. So through them, they receive like a sandwich, things of that nature, vegetables and stuff like that. It means a lot because, as we know, kids, they are guaranteed breakfast and lunch at school. But now that school is out, parents are sometimes concerned while providing that extra meal for them. So having this summer feeding program through the different sites that we work with helps alleviate parents' concerns of having a meal for their
child. You want cucumbers? All right, my first order of cucumbers.
This program is funded by the USDA. According to Feeding America's most recent Map the Meal Gap report, more than 33,000 children in Lake and Porter counties, or one in five, are considered food insecure.
And sometimes they will come back, they will want, you know, two breakfasts, two lunches, and we give it to them because we know that. Sometimes they don't have a meal at home. So we'll supply them with whatever they need, even if it's after lunch, you know, and they need a sandwich. And some of them, their parents may be a little late coming to get them and they're hungry. So we just supply that for them and keep them engaged with something to do so their little minds are always engaged.
For more information, you can go to foodbanknwi.org/summerfeeding. That's foodbanknwi.org/summerfeeding. Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. State Representative Charlie Brown is working towards putting an end to food deserts in Indiana. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson has more.
I am in the process of writing a letter to Jewel Osco that says, "Why not Gary, Indiana?" I'm in the process of sending a letter to CVS saying, fill that void being left by Walgreens. You know, you can make money off of the city of Gary by locating a store within the corporate limits of Gary.
The American Nutrition Association defines a food desert as an urban area in which it is difficult to buy affordable or good quality fresh food. This is largely due to a lack of grocery stores, farmers markets, and healthy food providers, and food deserts are usually found in impoverished areas. Brown, who represents District 3, which covers Gary, says a major portion of his district is in a food desert.
It's so unfair and unfortunate that Gary is just dumped on an ongoing basis that yes, people here, be they school teachers, be they doctors, be they just plain ordinary workers in the steel mills or whatever, they are inconvenienced by having to get what their needs, be they pharmaceuticals, be they clothing, be they groceries, have to go outside of the corporate limits of Garrett to make those purchases.
And many people who live in impoverished areas not only make very little money, but many don't have a car, and they can live anywhere from a mile or more from the closest grocery store. Gary resident Lorraine Lewis doesn't have a vehicle. The proximity between her residence and the local grocery store costs her about 1 hour of her time just to make a trip to the market.
How close is that to your house?
Maybe a bus ride. Just one bus.
How long is the bus ride?
Well, two buses now. Because I moved on 53rd. But when I stayed on 35th, it was just one bus.
How long of a trip is that for you?
When I was on 35th, it may be about 20-minute ride.
And now you're on 53rd. How long is the trip?
Oh, that's two. It's two bus rides. It's about an hour. But, you know, you do what you do. You know, you do what you got to do to survive.
And now, with the closing of many Strack and Van Til properties in Northwest Indiana, it makes the situation even more challenging. What impact is that going to have on...
Well, it just compounds the situation, because now I think that a couple of the stores that they are planning to close will be converted to a Jewel Osco. But nonetheless, that's still, those will be outside of corporate limits of Gary.
Brown says he hasn't spoken to corporate leaders about why they don't locate their store in Gary, but he has spoken to lobbyists.
They come to me and ask for my vote to make it more convenient for them, revenue-wise or store-wise. And I say, why then don't you open a store in my district, within my city? And the answer is always, the surveys that we do indicate that that would not be profitable to us. Well, everything isn't on your bottom line. It's a matter of providing services to people that need those services. And so I am taking the posture that don't come to me, large box stores, don't come to me asking me to support an endeavor of yours in the Indiana General Assembly if you are turning your back on my community.
Charles Jones, who is originally from Gary but now lives in Merrillville, remembers what it was like when he lived a far distance from the closest grocery store.
Where I used to live on 11th, and the closest one there is all the way on Grant. So that's pretty far. That's about a good 10, 15-minute drive.
How many miles do you think that is?
That is probably maybe about
15 miles.
Yeah, about just about, almost. Usually, if you want certain foods or anything like that, you have to probably have to go into Merrillville, because that grocery that's down here on Grant doesn't have a lot of it. But I mean, it all depends on what you're looking for. And then if you need groceries, you got to go to the grocery store. So it's out the way, because it's all the way on the other side of town. But at the same time, I mean, you got to do what you got
to
do.
We need to rattle that chain, that saber, and say, no more will I come and spend my dollars with you if you won't come into the corporate limits of Gary. There's no reason why there should not and could not be a store right at Route 20 and Route 51, State Road 51. That large, right off of the expressway, that even those that are outside of the corporate limits of Gary could have easy access to stores there.
Brown says the Senate will study the food desert issue in September and October, and there will be proposals made during the 2018 legislative session.
More than likely, legislation, the summer study committees will gear up sometime late August or September, in which the issue of food deserts will be studied, and then there will be proposals for legislation to correct those incidences across the state, where many people do not have access to fresh food. Hopefully, we will have one, two, maybe three pieces of legislation dealing with that subject matter.
A solution would help a lot of people, people like Lorraine, who Lakeshore Public Radio spoke to. She was forced to end our conversation because she had to run for the bus with shopping bags in hand.
You know, you do what you got to do to survive.
Hey!
Gotta go.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Having a parent behind bars can poorly impact a child's behavioral, emotional, and even physical health. A new community-led research project in Indianapolis seeks to understand that link more clearly. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan has more.
A social determinant of health, a condition or circumstance that plays into how a person is born, grows, lives, and ages.
I noticed a change in my son, me not being there, because of being incarcerated.
Terrell Harris's son was young when Harris spent 2 years in prison on a drug charge. Now Harris is part of a research project that aims to identify how incarceration impacts family health.
I mean, it kind of puts them in a stressful situation because they're wishing their dad was here. Also, it takes away from that structure that they're normally used to on a normal day-to-day basis.
And it can be more than mental health problems. Some studies point to long-term physical health issues like heart problems and asthma, but the research is limited. This project aims to add data. Volunteers will go into communities to talk to people who have been impacted by the incarceration of a loved one and ask questions about how that has impacted the family's health. About 75 volunteers attended a summit last month held by the Indianapolis Congressional Action Network, or IndyCan, a nonprofit group helping to organize the research. More than 1 in 10 Indiana youth have a parent who has been incarcerated, the second highest rate in the nation.
But the hard part is like that plan.
IndyCan Executive Director Shoshana Spector led a session. She says incarceration should be a last resort, not a first response.
No child should be afraid that they'll never see their parents, even if it's just 6 weeks or 6 months, when there's plenty of alternatives.
Alternatives such as treatment and diversion strategies like crisis intervention. Spector says if communities don't commit to reducing the number of people being incarcerated, the cycle will just continue.
We are traumatizing people for generations.
The U.S. leads the world with incarceration rates, and Indiana has a 7% higher rate than the national average. Director of Riley Childhood Development Center, Angela Tomlin, says the social determinant of having a parent incarcerated can be a child's first strike.
So you think about it, everything is related all the way back to those early relationships and safe environments.
Tomlin is the research project psychologist.
Stress over time can build up, and what we've been finding through many different studies is that these effects of stress can persist into adulthood.
Black teens in Indiana are twice as likely to have a parent in jail as whites. Some evidence points to the relationship of mass incarceration and racial health inequity. This is the sort of data that the IndyCan project hopes to build on. Project volunteer Terrell Harris's wife served 10 years. She went to prison when her son was 2 and got out when he was 13.
So now imagine a son that you've never seen all these years and get out and trying to be a mother to that child. You know how much resentment that child has against you because you were gone?
Harris says that resentment and stress has led to health problems.
And now he's suffered from PTSD, ADHD, you know, because, you know, he's been in these messed up situations. And now he thinks that's the cool. Now, because he has to live up to a status quo that his parents were incarcerated.
The group hopes to present their findings to the Indiana legislature next year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting and Side Effects Public Media, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Ivy Tech Community College will undergo administrative changes this summer aimed at making each campus more community-focused, addressing the needs expressed by campuses across the state. Ivy Tech's campuses currently serve students at a regional level, but going forward, they will focus on specific towns. Every campus will have leadership focused on the specific needs of the town the campus is located in. Academics and local partnerships will focus on the specific workforce needed of that community. Ivy Tech President Sue Elsperman says, for example, rather than one campus serving both Muncie and Anderson, each location will focus on specific needs of that community. Elsperman said, quote, "We'll put in more focus into how we interact with K-12 and traditional students, as well as that adult workforce that we as a state need to come back and skill up to take on middle-skilled jobs across Indiana's economy," unquote. The changes do not mean additional or fewer jobs, and there will be no additional buildings constructed. The administrative changes will be completed by August 1st. You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. 2 years ago, a mental health advocate named Steve McGaffrey stood at a lectern in the Indiana State House, testifying in favor of an addiction treatment bill. After years of rising overdose rates, lawmakers in the Health Committee were taking action to combat the opioid epidemic. They often turned to McAfee, who leads Mental Health America of Indiana, to advise them. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Sarah Fendham has more.
For the millions of Americans addicted to opioids like heroin and prescription painkillers, some of the most effective treatments are medications. But addiction treatment is also a business. And an investigation by NPR and Side Effects Public Media reveals that the manufacturer of one of those medications is trying to make it harder to access its competitors. And this is happening across the United States. Jake Harper of member station WFYI starts us out in Indianapolis.
These are the films. They also have the pill. Okay. That's what it looks like.
Angela and Nate Turner were trying to quit heroin last year. So they saw a doctor, and he prescribed a drug called Suboxone. Angela said it helped her feel normal.
So you could function?
Yeah, you can function, but you're not high.
But she had to wait to get her prescription filled. It took 3 days for her insurance company to agree to pay for the medication. The wait put her into withdrawals.
Laying in bed, going through cold sweats, hot sweats, diarrhea.
Angela had to take care of her daughter. She was tempted to go back and use.
It's either that or lay there and not being able to get up and feed your kid and do what you're supposed to be doing, you know?
For her husband, Nate, the wait was too much. He used heroin again. If the Turners had been prescribed another drug called Vivitrol, they wouldn't have faced the same delays. But that wasn't the medication their doctor thought they needed. The three FDA-approved addiction medicines work differently for different patients, and addiction experts say they all need to be available. But in many places, options are limited. Alkermes, the company that makes Vivitrol, has lobbied in state houses around the country and Congress to promote its drug. Its lobbyists are pushing for regulations that put other treatments at a disadvantage, and also for laws that explicitly favor Vivitrol. The approach was blatant at a hearing a couple years ago, February 4th, 2015, the Indiana House Committee on Public Health.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Representative Steve Davison introduced a bill to allow insurers to delay paying for drugs like Suboxone, like what happened to Angela and Nate. This is what's called prior authorization. And the bill would forbid those delays on another medication.
The drug that we're referring to here is Vivitrol.
Davison explained why.
What that does is it encourages folks to go with the non-addictive medications as their first choice.
Wow. Yeah, I saw that for the first time today.
I showed the bill to Basha Indraka Christu, a researcher at the Fairbanks School of Public Health.
So to have, you know, in legislation specifically stating that one medication needs prior authorization while another one doesn't, that is pretty explicitly saying that we're going to hamper one medication more so than the other.
She has a problem with the phrase non-addictive medication, too. I'll come back to that. But Alkermes had a hand in this bill. Davison said that one of Indiana's best-known advocates for addiction policy, a man named Steve McCaffrey, helped draft it. McCaffrey runs a nonprofit called Mental Health America of Indiana. And that day in February, he testified on the bill.
We need to move Indiana toward evidence-based treatment. This bill would do that. Appreciate it.
McCaffrey didn't mention that he's also a lobbyist for Alkermes, but state records show he is.
Do people in the State House that you work with, do they know about this Alkermes connection?
I mean, I imagine some do and some don't.
I asked several lawmakers who have worked with McCaffrey on addiction issues, and none of them knew he lobbied for the company. And McCaffrey's efforts helped Indiana become what Alkermes calls an up-and-coming state, where the drug sales are set to rise. Vivitrol is a shot of a drug called naltrexone, and it could be a blockbuster for Alkermes. Sales could reach $1 billion within the next few years. At an investor event in 2016, CEO Richard Pops said his company has a special mission.
We find ourselves really deeply dedicated to bringing new medicines to patients and profoundly affecting their lives.
But to do that, they're using tactics that fuel misconceptions about addiction. There are only three drugs that can treat opioid addiction.
All these medications have their pros and cons.
Andy Chambers is a psychiatrist in Indianapolis. It breaks down like this. Two of the drugs are actually opioids, methadone and buprenorphine, better known as Suboxone, the drug the Turners were taking. They reduce cravings and prevent withdrawals and help people get their lives together.
If the addiction is the monster, methadone and Suboxone cage the monster.
There are decades of research to back this up. But Chambers says it's hard for some people to grasp using an opioid to treat opioid addiction.
I think that when you sit down with people and you explain it and you talk about the science, eventually most people can get it. But, you know, there's some people that just can't accept it.
Then there's Vivitrol, which he says avoids some of that stigma.
Vivitrol is not an opioid. In fact, it's an opioid blocker.
For policymakers who are not experts in addiction medicine, that's really appealing. But Vivitrol is not a one-size-fits-all solution. It's expensive, and to use it, patients must first go through a painful detox. Policies favoring Vivitrol can hurt people who need the other drugs, people like Angela and Nate Turner. Indiana's state code now has at least 11 instances of a phrase that describes Vivitrol in sections dealing with criminal justice and addiction treatment. The term again.
The non-addictive medication.
Andraka Christou, the researcher, says that using that phrase again and again could feed into stigma.
Even using non-addictive suggests that the other ones are super addictive, even though for most people, they're helpful and not abused.
To Corey Waller with the American Society of Addiction Medicine, promoting a brand name drug in law is a problem.
I think anyone who's willing to put somebody's advertisement in legislation should be ashamed of themselves.
And he says Alkermes is using the stigma surrounding the other addiction medicines to tilt policy in its favor.
It's a little bit beyond the pale when they start to lock things down. When they lock down access to evidence-based treatments via legislation, and that's their goal, I have to say it's just unethical.
Alkermes is targeting other states, too. We found variations of that phrase that refers to Vivitrol in dozens of bills outside Indiana. And the company is supporting efforts that could hamper access to other treatments. State Senator John Eklund authored a bill in Ohio, which adds regulations to buprenorphine prescribers. Critics say making it harder to prescribe medicines like Suboxone may make some doctors steer clear entirely. But Alkermes...
They applauded the bill. Their interest was in, is there anything that they can do because Suboxone had such a toehold here in the state of Ohio and, you know, they're looking to expand their business.
Alkermes spent years lobbying at the federal level too, spreading one-sided information about buprenorphine and pushing for tighter regulation of the drug. A Democratic congressional staffer told me it was one of the most intense, frustrating lobbying efforts they had ever seen. After our initial interview, Steve McCaffrey, the lobbyist in Indiana, wouldn't talk further. He says he's in favor of all treatment options.
I've always said that we need to use all the tools in the toolbox for treatment.
But a list of bills McCaffrey has worked on shows a pattern of favoring Vivitrol and adding regulations to buprenorphine and methadone. Leaders at Alkermes wouldn't talk to us. In a written statement, the company echoed McCaffrey, saying doctors should determine what medication is prescribed. But behind the scenes, Alkermes is trying to make that harder. And policies the company supports can hurt people like Angela and Nate Turner. They said having to wait days for their medication was wrong, and that doctors got them hooked on opioid painkillers. It was difficult for a doctor to help them quit.
Yeah, we're not trying to just get pain medication just to get it. We're actually need these things to help us back into
society
right? And be productive.
The people who treat addiction say that's the goal with every patient. And the millions of people suffering from the disease need access to all of the medications, not just one. For NPR News, I'm Jake Harper.
You can find more about this investigation at npr.org. This story was produced in collaboration with Side Effects Public Media and WFYI.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. John Kane, host of Eye in the Arts, talks with Derek Braggs, a board member of Tall Tree Arboretum and Garden, about the ongoing Acorn Concert Series. Here's that conversation.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Derek Braggs, a board member with the Tall Tree Arboretum. And Derek, it's just so refreshing to have a board member rather than a staff person come to represent the organization, any organization.
Yes, well, I'm happy to be here.
How long have you been on the board?
A little over a year, but I started out with Tall Tree as a volunteer for a number of years before that.
Oh, so you have a genuine interest
Yes. It's right down the nature from where I live, and it's my go-to on a Saturday afternoon.
So, is it really?
Yes, it is.
Oh, that's fantastic. Are you an officer on the board?
No. No, just a new board member.
It sounds like you're a very enthusiastic and good one.
Yes. Yeah. I try.
Well, we all the nonprofit organizations need great board members.
Yes.
To sustain them. So that's great. I think it's one of the most beautiful places in Northwest Indiana.
I couldn't agree more.
I love that tree. The council tree.
Okay. Yeah. The signature tree is the one right off of the parking lot.
Well, it was back in there always.
Okay.
where the Potawatomi
Indians. So you've been off on the trails.
I I was given on a golf cart a few years ago.
I've done the golf cart tour before, you? Yes.
So that giant, like, bazillion-year-old tree.
Yes, yes.
Prehistoric or whatever it is.
That's correct.
Is it an oak?
Yeah, they're all bur oaks, I believe.
So. It was something. Yeah, it's a great place. And the trains.
The trains.
Oh, my gosh.
One of the most spectacular train exhibits maybe in the world. Yeah. I don't know.
And it's right here in Northwest
Indiana. And it's right here.
Practically on the border of Lake and Porter counties, kind of. Yes. Well, kind of, sort of. Well, all right. So every summer you do a concert series.
Correct.
And it's just recently commenced for this 2017 season.
Correct.
So what's slated for the rest of the summer?
We've got 5 events scheduled throughout the summer months, July 8th, August 12th, and September 2nd, September 16th. And each event will have an opener and a headline act. Mm-hmm. And we've got a fantastic lineup. I'm just as excited for the opening acts as I am for the headline act.
And so tell us about that one, since we want people to.
So July 8th is really, that's our Independence Day celebration. It's the Saturday after 4th of July. We have a headliner is the Black Lilies, and the opener is a band called the Wait on Wanderers. Both of these bands are national touring acts, very talented, and we'll have a fireworks display that's going to break up the set for the headliner. We're really looking forward to it. This is the second year of the 4th of July-ish event, and we had a great time last year. Last year the theme was Red, White, and Blues. This year it's God Bless Americana.
Oh, neat.
So
you, how many people attend the concerts on average?
We've, right around 500-600 people.
Wow.
Yeah. We're going into our third season, and the first year it was just a single event. Last year we did 3 events. This year, like I said, we've got 5 events planned, and it's growing by word of mouth. Mm-hmm. And really, the great thing about the concert series is it's getting a lot of people out to the Arboretum that have never been out there before.
Sure.
And I can't tell you how many people have come up to me and said that, you know, I didn't know this place existed. Or people that did know about it that had never been out there, they come up and they comment that they didn't realize how really incredible that place is. So
that's true. Is there an admission for attending?
There is, yes. Tickets are $15 a piece, and they are available at www.talltree.org on the events page. We'll have Indiana Beverage is going to be coming out. Actually, for the July 8th event, Lagunitas is one of our sponsors.
Oh, nice.
So they will be coming out and taking over the taps. And we'll have Cala Vista Wines, which is a winery in Argentina. So both of them will be present. We've got food trucks. So
it's not a teetotaling event. You can teetotal if you want to,
correct,
but you don't have to.
Yes.
That's good. And people bring blankets and lawn chairs and stuff?
Bring a lawn chair, yep, and make yourself comfortable.
They can bring a picnic lunch, or it's an evening thing, of course.
It is. It's in the evening, and we used to do coolers out at Tall Tree, but we do have the food vendors and the drink vendors out there now.
Right. You said that. Okay. Well, it does sound blissful, I must say. For if you have to go outdoors, it sounds like a really nice way to do it.
Yes.
All right. Well, Derek, thank you for being here and for representing your organization, and I'm glad you are involved.
All right. Thank you
very much. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
Beginning this coming school year, the 7 Porter County School Districts are going to participate in a joint effort to give the families of first graders an opportunity to be able to save for college, vocational, trade school, or other post-secondary educational facilities. Julie Georgie is the Promise Porter County coordinator. She spoke with Chris Nolte on Wednesday, June 14th, to talk about the program, the enrollment process, and where to get more information. Here's that conversation.
Well, we're very excited to be bringing this to Porter County. It's been a couple years in the making. The Promise Indiana organization has been around for about 4 years, started in Wabash, Indiana, and the idea was to enroll every first grade family that, well, they did K through three, but we are going to do first grade families in a free college savings account through College Choice 529, which is Indiana's college savings plan. So the plan is we have 28 individual schools in Porter County and over 1,800 first graders. So come next fall, we are going to be at various back-to-school events at every school, enrolling these students, the families that want to, in the program. They will get a initial deposit, generously donated by Urschel Laboratories, of $25 into their account. They don't need to do anything to get that. Simply enroll, and if that's all they want to do the whole time, that's all they have to do. But we're going to also be encouraging them through some college and career curriculum in their first grade classrooms to start thinking about what it's going to mean to go to college, what they might like to do, just various aspects of heading on to post-secondary education. And then we'll have a period of time called the Champions Match, where we're going to encourage these first graders and their families to go to their champions. It may be family members, friends, coaches, teachers, anyone that they would go to, and ask them to support them in their quest to go to college.
Now, there's some interesting facts and figures that have come out here from the state, and I know you've looked them over, and I'm sure a lot of this has been some good ways to encourage support of the program. That it's a benefit for family members to get started very early in trying to set up savings accounts for their children's education.
College savings plans have come a long way in the last 10 or 15 years, and 529 plans are the best way to save for college right now. There are tax advantages. The money can be used it's generous in terms of what you do. It doesn't have to be a traditional four-year college. You can go to trade or technical schools, two-year colleges. You can use it for even textbooks and computer expenses. So they're very generous in how you can use it, and as long as they're used for educational expenses towards any, from any program that takes federal financial aid, they can withdraw the money tax-free. So that's just a huge benefit to families. And if you start early, then the money has this chance to grow. We're going to, as I was talking about the champions, we will match if the families are able to put in $25 of their own money during our champions period, which will be in October, we will match that $25 with an additional $25. So potentially by the end of October, the kids could have $75 or more in their savings account already.
Now, take us through the start of the program. We know it's going to get underway with the beginning of the 2017-2018 school year in all of the Porter County school districts. What will parents have a chance to see or do when school starts, or maybe they'll get something in the mail before classes get underway to tell them more about this program, about the 529 College Savings Account program, as well as the local program, and how they can get involved?
Yes, we've already been in contact with every first grade family through email and through a letter that went home to kind of tell them what to look for come fall. And we will continue to be in contact with them through their school, through their individual schools, over the course of the summer as the plans finalize for their each individual enrollment. So that they will come to a back-to-school, it could be a back-to-school evening, it could be registration. Each school was able to kind of select which event they thought would work best for them. And then they will come into the school, have the opportunity to either do this online, in the computer lab, or we also have we'll have paper and pencil that if they would prefer to do that like in that way. And once they've done the online registration, because even if they do paper and pencil, they'll have to confirm online eventually. Once they do that, we'll put the money in their accounts a month or so later, and they'll be ready to go.
Now, Julie, I understand that there are going to be some very interesting activities that are going to be involved. You might have mentioned that here at the outset of our conversation, but one in particular, where participating first graders and family members are going to have a chance to visit a big campus. At least it's big to them. They're young people. They're little people. They probably aren't used to, unless they've been to Valparaiso University for other reasons, they're probably going to be very impressed with what they see.
Exactly. That's an event called Walk Into My Future, and we are going to hold that in April of 2018. And I actually was just meeting with the Valparaiso University contact today. So we're that's a great topic to talk about right now. I'm all great. Excited about it. We're going to be bringing every student onto campus for some age-appropriate activities, get them to meet some students and professors from the campus and walk around and just kind of get a feel what college is really like.
Now, have you had any questions from parents or other people about this program? And what do you tell them if they do have questions about it?
Some of the biggest questions have been about what if my child doesn't actually end up going to college, those kind of things. And so the 529 plans that have been developed are very flexible in terms of that. So if one child is just not going to go to school, the plan, you're able to transfer it to other family members. So that's a big question. Another question has been, what if my child already has a 529 plan? And we will be enrolling, even if they already have a 529 plan, if they want to transfer it into College Choice 529, then they'll get all the be eligible for all the promise grants and money that comes through our program. And if they already have a College Choice 529 plan, which is Indiana's, and they're in our cohort, which will be the first graders next school year, they will also be able to participate in every aspect of the program.
Now, if you'd like to find out more information about this particular program, the Promise Porter County program, you can go on as well, check out the website. And there's also, by the way, on Facebook, you can find out more at Promise Porter County, all one word. And then there's, I guess, a YouTube video as well, too, that explains some things, too, isn't it, Julie?
Yes. It actually shows a walk that took place last fall at Purdue University, and we've been enjoying showing that around. I think that really motivates families and children to want to participate in the program. It's pretty neat. So.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
Regionally speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program's link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition from NPR News with local host Sharon Jackson on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure to search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sarah Dykstra.